Okay, welcome to this research seminar for the Hellenic Observatory here at the LSE. It's a great pleasure to introduce Marilena Anastasopoulou. Marilena is a new postdoc in the Hellenic Observatory, an ESRC postdoc. Let me, by way of introduction, mention a few things. So, Marilena Anastasopoulou is a historian of modern migration. As I say, she is an ESRC postdoctoral fellow with us. She completed her PhD at the University of Oxford, which was entitled Coming to Terms with Forced Migration, an Intergenerational Study of Asia Minor Refugee Memory in Greece. She has previously studied at Oxford also for a master's degree, and at the University of Athens as well. Her PhD received a number of prestigious awards, and Marilena has also taught at the University of Oxford, again winning awards for her teaching as lecturer in history at Pembroke College and in the Faculty of History. She is also a research associate of what we know as CSOCS, the Southeast European Studies Programme at Oxford at St. Anthony's College. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Marilena as a ESRC postdoc in the Hellenic Observatory. Let me say something about her research. So Marilena is going to tell us about a new book she's writing. The research that she's doing at the Hellenic Observatory is partially based on her PhD, but seeks to extend the PhD with comparative case studies. And the comparative study, it is comparative in that it is intergenerational and also interregional. It's a history of Asia Minor memories and identities of forced displacements, and it examines the complex relationship between contemporary attitudes and the refugee past. Of course, given the centenary of the Asia Minor population transfer and the current migration and refugee crisis, their study is highly topical in that it explores refugee memories and identities of expulsion, the intergenerational transmission, and the way people with these memories think about today's migration. How have memories of 1922-24 forced displacement changed over time from one generation to the next? How do people with these memories and identities think about subsequent migration? Her research implies a number of different methodologies, particularly oral history, and she draws upon literature from a number of different subjects. She has used oral testimonies, 262 life history interviews, and archival evidence using over 5,000 oral testimonies. And now she's basing her research on three regional case studies: the borderland island of Lesbos, Central Macedonia, and Attica. And the research brings together the intersection of three interlocking elements: time, that is distinguishing refugee generations; place, refugee locations; and subsequent migrations, waves of other migrations. So in short, coming to terms with forced migration sheds light on the convoluted relationship between contemporary attitudes and the refugee past, and providing a nuanced history of the 1922-24 memories and identities of forced displacement. So we're not only pleased, delighted that Marilena has joined the Observatory to do this research, but we're also very pleased that she's talking to us this evening at the beginning of this new phase of her research, so we can deal with a broad canvas and I'm sure there'll be many interesting contributions and questions from you as well. So Marilena, welcome, and we look forward to your presentation.
Thank you very much, Kevin. I'm truly flattered. Thank you, it was a great honor. Hello everyone, thank you very much for being here. Profuse thanks are due first of all to the Hellenic Observatory. Thank you for the kind introduction, Arete and Maria, thanks for organizing. So let's start. Coming to terms with forced migration. Very briefly, I'm exploring the attitudes of those who were refugees in the past towards refugees in the present. Are these people more sympathetic or hostile to subsequent waves of migrants? In this presentation, I will guide you through this question, briefly overviewing the historical context, the conceptual and methodological tools, a case study, and the main findings of my research. In 2015, during Europe's migration crisis, the Greek island of Lesbos became a symbol of hospitality worldwide, hosting vast numbers of displaced people. At the same time, the island's residents were emphasizing their own refugee identity, explaining to me that their parents were refugees from Turkey, and this is why they feel sympathy towards the newcomers. What is so striking about Lesbos is that it hosts significant contemporary migration, while at the same time a large part of its population descends from refugees from Asia Minor. In Greece, the case of Lesbos is far from rare. In 1923, Greece and Turkey agreed to the compulsory exchange of populations of the religious minorities, a story central to the Greek identity that poses international interest since it was the first compulsory population exchange in history. In this context, it comes into question, how have memories and identities of the 1922-24 forced displacement changed over time from one generation to the next? And how do people with these memories and identities think about subsequent migration? Tracing refugee memories and identities, I collected archival evidence, 5,000 oral testimonies, and conducted over 260 interviews. The oral history approach enabled me to provide a diverse account of Asia Minor refugee memory, talking to people and tracing their voices. And I also followed a regional history approach, focusing on three geographic areas across Greece, namely the borderland island of Lesbos, central Macedonia, northern Greece, and Greece's most populous and cosmopolitan region, Attica. And there you can see the fieldwork locations. Vaguely, perhaps. Well, the conceptual tools of this research are memory and identity. I look at three different levels of memory: individual, collective, and public memories of displacement. However, given that trauma is both the event and the memory of the event, I also examined refugee memory as experienced through its transfer. From the first generation, the generation with a direct experience, to the following generations, their children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, four generations of Asia Minor refugees. Memory and identity construct each other. From silence to latency and ultimately a reawakening, intergenerational refugee memory and identity pass through the different stages of trauma and change throughout different historical periods. For example, Vasos Vekiatsoglou, one of my interviewees, born in 1935 in Athens, noted, and I quote, "When I was a kid at school, I used to mutter my last name. I was ashamed to say Oglu. I'm proud of it now." Overall, for the first two generations, Asia Minor refugee memory and identity becomes refugee, being isolated in the private sphere, and it is gradually transformed into a citizen, entering the public sphere for the third and the fourth generation. In order to examine the intersection of Asia Minor refugee identity with other migration and refugee identities, the following analysis focuses on one regional case study, just across the Aegean, the case of Lesbos. So Very briefly about Lesbos. The borderland island of Lesbos constitutes an entry port, a transit point, and a place of settlement for significant past and contemporary migration waves. Lesbos is characterized by its proximity to Turkey, as you can see on the map, its position as an irregular migration route, and by the flood of refugees in 1922-24, and its long-standing left-wing political leanings. And those are particularities of its geographic, historical, and identity composition, respectively. The proximity to the Asia Minor coast and the extreme and unexpected dimension of this displacement compose the uniqueness of this traumatic memory and the shaping of the islanders' identity. Forced displacement, reception conditions, and the tense relations with the native population depict the main facets of the Asia Minor hood on the island. Born in 1964, Stratis Balaskas recounted the forced displacement of his father, Panagiotis, who arrived as an unaccompanied minor on the island at the age of six. He said, and I quote, "This is a story of the catastrophe. In 1922, they left. My grandfather was executed. The Turks took over Pergamos. They hung him at a tree in front of the house. The girls left, my grandma, with my grandmother and their brother. On the way, nobody knows what happened. The girls were lost. My grandmother was lost. And my father, Panagiotis, someone just threw him into a boat. He got into a boat and he can't remember anything. He never said anything, he remembered nothing." In this context, or in the context of this experience, the concept of silence emerges, leading to a non-linear and non-directly referential transmission of these memories. Intergenerational memory. So we have familial frameworks of remembrance and collective frameworks of remembrance. The familial frameworks of remembrance. The breaking of silence in the context of a family is stimulated by grandchildren, with grandparents sharing their stories of forced displacement with their grandchildren, mostly towards the end of their lives. Family memory appears to leap a generation, with a transmission mechanism of family histories usually happens in the following sequence, from the first to the third generation, and from the second generation to the fourth generation. In many cases, Asia Minor refugees were not willing to share the stories of displacement due to the fear of evoking pain, traumatizing their descendants, or precluding their descendants' integration. Salome Dikidiki, born in 1946, revealed that she discovered her family history almost exclusively through her grandmother. She said, and I quote, "My grandmother still mentally lived in Asia Minor. The entire day she would say, when will we go back? When we will go to see our house so you can see it? If my mom would talk about these things, my mom, no, not much." Collective frameworks of remembrance, you can see a memorial and five generations of Asia Minor refugees, and then a refugee association with different generations. Collective memory is shaped by different forms of remembrance and extra-familiar practices. The most prominent expressions are refugee settlements, associations, museums, and memorials. National memory beyond limited expressions from Asia Minor politicians on the island is absent. But of course, the balance between the different levels of memory changes throughout time. Asia Minor refugee memory reawakens between the 1980s and 2000s. Where we have the establishment of collective frameworks of remembrance, and these frameworks are established from below. We have the creation of a refugee museum and the establishment, the foundation of various refugee associations between the late 1990s and the early 2000s. Dimitris Papachrysos, born in 1951, who is the president of the 1922 Refugee Memorial Museum and the Refugee Association in one of the refugee settlements, said that we started to bring to our mind the memories that each of us had heard from his parents who were refugees, and in fact, in a village that was purely of refugees, and each person started saying their story. when we had started doing these events, we had all acquired Asia Minor conscience. So in the case of Lesbos, the traumatic dimension of Asia Minor displacement and the transfer of this memory shaped strong intergenerational identities. Intergenerational identity. Although the term refugee does not technically apply to this group of displaced people, it appears as a persistent term throughout generations. And of course, we need to know that the terms people use to describe themselves are sociologically significant. So this part unpacks whether and at what point the subjects stop being explainable primarily as refugees, and their attachment to imagined Asia Minor, national Greece, and local Lesbos identities. I will only give you a very brief indication of intergenerational refugee identities in Lesbos through some of my interviewees. So Salome Dekidiki, born in 1948, she's a descendant of the second generation. Her ancestors' place of origin becomes her place of origin, and their identity a defining part of her identity, illustrating an enduring sense of belonging, of Asia Minor belonging. Despite being married to a native, her friends were almost exclusively from Asia Minor, and Salome said, and I quote, "I was born on Lesbos, so I'm Greek, but my grandmother and my parents are from Asia Minor, and so I'm from there too. And then I ask, so do you feel like a local or a refugee?" And Salome replied, "Local here? Oh, no, 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 no. But who can go there at this point? Even if you go, you get angry, sad. Now I feel connected to the island, but my heart." Another interviewee, Stratis, rejects the identity of the native, challenging the Greek component of his identity and emphasizing the Asia Minor components and refugee components of his identification. He said, "Even today, I feel that I'm in Mytilene because the boat brought us here. I'm not a native to call myself a native. I'm a refugee roaming Greece. I'm from Asia Minor. I live in Lesbos. I'm in Greece. I'm an Asia Minor Rom." So the extent to which different identities are triggered in different places is discussed by Niki Hontronikola, born in 1992, who is a descendant of the fourth generation. And Niki illustrated the contextual dimensions of her identification, saying that it's difficult. When I'm here, I want to say Asia Minor. When I'm in the rest of Greece, I want to say Lesbos. When I'm abroad, I'm forced to say Greece and then Lesbos. So building on Niki's hybrid, to an extent, identity, a more nuanced understanding of self-identification of the fourth generation comes to light. In this context, descendants of this generation adopt a more complex and multidimensional way, not only of the way they view themselves, but also in the way in relation to others, in relation to the others. So this brings me to the second part of the presentation, subsequent migration, the islanders and the outlanders. The construction of identities of descendants of Asia Minor refugees is examined not only with regards to the formation of their lives, but also with regard to the stances towards subsequent migrants and refugees. In the case of Lesbos, the population mosaic is composed of the native population, people with no refugee background, the old settlement group, Asia Minor refugee descendants with various levels of integration as its core, and then we have recent settlement groups, mainly Albanians, Romanians, and Bulgarians in the 90s, and the contemporary ethnic outgroups, the unfolding migration and refugee flows. In this space, hostility evolves into acceptance due to outgroups' gradual integration into the host society. And the outsiders become the established due to the arrival of a new outgroup. And we're going to discuss about it very briefly. So in the 90s, Asia Minor refugee descendants came across new outsiders, with the Albanian outgroup dominating this migration wave. In this context, past memories of forced displacement played a key role in Albanians' reception into the host society of Lesbos. Asia Minor refugee descendants refer to this gradual evolution of hostility into acceptance and attribute Albanians' integration into various factors, such as the labor market, the learning of the Greek language, upward mobility, hard work, exogamy, and religion. The sentence also reflects from a current day perspective on their attitudes towards Albanians and conclude that, in addition to the above parameters, the position of this outgroup was further reassessed and stabilized during the contemporary migration crisis and the arrival of the new outsiders. Stratis concluded that it was only after the contemporary migration crisis that the Albanians started being perceived as integrated. He said, "Now, due to the rise of the migration issue, nobody wants to deal with the Albanians, and the Albanians are almost integrated. But back then, nobody wanted them." Migration crisis, historically formed subjectivities and contemporary attitudes. So the extent to which past experiences of forced displacement are associated with the emergence of empathy or hostility is traced across generations and geographical locations. Empathy and historical parallels. In 2015, the arrival of vast numbers of migrants and refugees marked the beginning of a migration crisis that caused reactions at a local level. These immediate reactions were saved by expressions of empathy, rooted in intergroup contact, perspective taking, and acknowledgement of similarity of experience. Interviewees referred to the reactivation of refugee memories, explaining, and I quote, "Everybody in Mytilene felt compassion, both then and now, because our memories came to light. I felt so moved because I thought that I was seeing my own people. I won't forget this." Similarly, another interviewee, and we have there the quote, Ralu Spanelli, parallel to stories of refugeehood and migration, and refer to the similarity of the nature of violent displacements between Syrians and Zmirnians, noting that at the beginning, it was the Syrians. We felt sorry for them because they had a life built, and those people were forced to leave. They reminded me, you know of whom, the Zmirnians. The first flows were refugee flows. We believe it. And we felt that we had many things in common with these people. The following flows were not refugee flows, but rather economic migrants. And with these we have a part, the Greeks. Greeks have many economic migrants. And I, too, have my aunt, who is an economic migrant in the USA. And all families have economic migrants abroad. So underlining the island's long migration history, other interviewees highlight that Lesbos was always a passageway. So theoretically, they say, we need to be much more accepting in this situation. And all those scholars suggest that intergroup contact and exposure are not likely to reduce hostility due to the transit migration and arrivals. Incidents of compassion emerge throughout Lesbos. In this context, or in the context of these interactions, Stratis Pothas met his stepson, or as he called him, his soul son, a refugee that Stratis considers a member of his family. He said, "We at the time, my wife and I, every Saturday night, made sandwiches from the church to have them ready in the morning. We prepared them together and we would feed our son in the house. Do you understand? That's why I say soul son. He doesn't come every day. At the time, she would come every day. Now she will definitely come every Saturday when my son will also come so we can eat together as a family." So these expressions of empathy and historical parallels are traced especially towards the first wave of migrants between 2015 and 2016, when organized help on the island was not prominent. Binary distinctions. Family history is rooted in most of the interviewees' attitudes, leading in many cases to different outcomes and reactions. On one hand, prejudice, negative views, and in some cases competition are mainly rooted in binary distinctions. In this context, tolerance and empathy increase towards ethnic groups that are perceived as refugees, Syrians. On the other hand, competitive victimization and hostility appears towards those considered to be migrants, the rest. one of my interviewees said, and I quote, "When they arrived in 2015, we helped them. We felt compassion because the Syrians came due to the war in a violent way." This means that you couldn't have not compared by thinking that in similar ways Myrna was set on fire. We ran in order to cook, to collect clothes, to go to the accommodation facilities. No, now though, there is no relation. This changes with the influx of migrants who have no relation with our humanitarian part. And another interviewee adds, "But I became racist. They put fires. They walk around. They go down to the port. They break things. They break illnesses. They are illegal. What are the Afghans and the Pakistanis who will kill and stab each other? What are they? Are they economic migrants? The Syrians left." Hostility and competition. In many cases, hostility and empathy present as interchanging facets of descendants' identity, leading to contested views. Conspiracy theories, preclusion from integration due to prejudice regarding migrants' unwillingness to work, an emphasis on language, religion, history, compose negative views and elements of alterity, through which Asian minor refugee descendants in most cases try to safeguard their identity in opposition to the other. Lastly, competitive victimization appears in antagonistic comparisons between the Asian minor forced displacement and the contemporary migration crisis. Despina Efthymiou, who was born in 1961, noted that there is no relation for me, there is no relation because Asian minors came in pain, having left their properties, their wealth behind. The Nigerians and the Pakistanis and the Afghans, look how they live in holes, in stone structure. Islam fights against Christianity. And similarly, a descendant of the fourth generation, Maria, born in 1983, recalled the way Asian minor refugees were treated by the native population, wondering why this new outgroup should be treated differently from her ancestors, who were treated with hostility. She said, and I quote, "I consider that the flows don't have any commonality between them. Now, I can't compare the expulsions from Asia Minor with this one. First of all, the people from Asia Minor created culture. What did this one came here to do? When the ones from across came, nobody welcomed them with open arms. Nobody helped them. Did anyone build them houses? Did anyone give them facilities? Did anyone give them money? Of course not. They come and did not integrate it because nobody welcomed them in the way we welcome those ones here now." So as you understand, empathy and historical parallels, binary distinctions, and competition are the main facets observed in descendants' attitudes in varying intensities across generations. So Asian minor refugee memory leads to completely different outcomes depending on how the subject of analysis understands their history and the sense of identity. The main question, so how do people with memories and identities of forced displacement think about subsequent migration? Are they becoming empathizers, antagonists, or rivals? So without ignoring the multiplicity of variables in play, I argue that Asian minor refugee history, memory, and identity acquire various meanings and interpretations, influencing descendants' attitudes in often conflicting ways. Refugee identity is a capacious and dynamic platform of ongoing understanding, as well as a limited space of domination and competition. This contention is situated at the heart of this research, leading both to the building of bridges and historical parallels with histories of others, and to their demolitions through hierarchies of acceptabilities and antagonistic comparisons. These emerging complexities remind us that it is quite unwise to overgeneralize about attitudes towards contemporary, towards migration, that can be quite volatile and contradictory. So describing this complexity, one of my interviews confessed, and I quote, "I don't know which are the opposing sides because sometimes I don't know what side I'm on. In the morning, I sympathize. I'm with them. At 10, I detest them. At 12, I save them. At 3, I hate them. At 7, I have to do something for them and I do it. And at 10, I cannot stand them. Elucidating the attitudes of refugee descendants, I bring together time, generations, place, geographies, and subsequent migration, waves of other migrations. I argue that the intersection of these three elements allow us an understanding of the continuities and discontinuities that characterize the genus phase attitudes of refugee descendants, leading to empathy, hostility, and competition. Geography matters, as regional and historical particularities inform elements such as the existence of different senses of refugee identity and varying degrees of exposure to subsequent migrations. Generation matters, as different generations express different attitudes based on their varying levels of integration into the whole society and diverse intensities of the refugee identity. Overall, lesbians are presented as gate openers, Macedonians as gatekeepers, and Athenians as pragmatists, being in between of the genus phase reactions. So using genus, the god of gates and transitions, beginnings and endings, to parallel its generation, the second generation sees into the refugee past with one face, the fourth generation into the refugee future with the other face, leaving the third generation in the middle of this fluid duality. So many facets of the compulsory population exchange have become central to various studies, but unlike most accounts, this work offers an intergenerational, interregional, comparative, and in-depth perspective, illuminating memories and identities of forced displacement among Asia Minor refugees and their descendants in the context of subsequent migration. 2023 is a centenary from the Asia Minor forced displacement that that marked the establishment of population transfers and displacements throughout the world. Many examples compose the unsettling of the modern world throughout different historical periods and regions, such as Central and Southeastern Europe, South Asia, the Middle East, and Africa. The circularity that migration history entails can be expressed with various similar and opposite patterns, connected and disconnected stories of migration. One of the stories is the history of migration in Greece and the historical parallel between the Greek-Turkish population exchange in 1923 and the contemporary migration and refugee flows in 2015. So today, in light of the current migration and refugee crisis, the critical understanding of these displacements echoes with new relevance. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marilyn. That's very much indeed highly topical, but also fascinating because there's many different dimensions to it. As usual, I'm going to, in a moment, invite your comments and questions, but let me start off perhaps with two tentative questions, one perhaps conceptual and the other empirical. I wonder, when we talk about past events, as you have elaborated, over time we give it many different meanings. And so you refer to, quote, memory and identity, but I guess these are concepts which are in tension, in conflict with each other in many respects. And dare I say that they can also be created. You referred to associations, you referred to various state actions. And I wonder how far you were finding that subsequent generations had no memory, of course, of the event, but were having an identity which is created not by family, but by government, states, institutions, associations, civil society, whatever. So I should feel such an identity, because this is the family I come from. However, within my family, we haven't had that direct transmission of memory. So I wondered, so the first point is, I wonder to what extent there's potential conflicts between memory and identity, where identity may be created by civil state institutions. And the second point, I guess, is that, like you, I'm fascinated by this differentiation of responses. So as it happens with Mitalini, then I think we've talked about this, I've been, and my daughter, who's working there for 3 years. What strikes me is this is an island of a very strong tradition of the left, with communist Kukue. And then we have very diverse outcomes in terms of your research today. So there seems to be complexity there when it comes to causality. When does X cause Y? This is an island in which I believe KCRG and the extreme whites have done very well in terms of support. And when there was the fire with the refugee camp in Kara Tepe, then it was very much the Kirisi Abgi who were imposing roadblocks and stopping humanitarian work except at 4 o'clock in the morning in very, very difficult circumstances. But I wonder, in terms of this more empirical question of when does X cause Y and the diversity, whether in your research you've distinguished time, geography, and waves of migration, whether you're finding specific subgroups who are more likely, A, to be racist and rejectionist, or B, inclusive and supportive. Are there common characteristics that of response A and response B? Or is it what you found more complex than that?
Okay. Thank you very much, Kevin, for the questions. So let's start by addressing the conceptual question regarding memory and identity. And I said that memory and identity inform and construct each other, but of course this is a very multidimensional and dynamic process. Memories and identities, and especially as a minor refugee, memory identity tends to be a very dynamic concept that changes throughout generations. Mm. You talk about the fourth generation and the different frameworks of either remembrance or identity construction. And you were right saying that, because I mentioned at some point during the presentation that it seems that Asia Minor refugee memory started as a refugee. There's a very clear distinction between the private sphere and the public sphere. Mm. So this identity, this memory, pretty much in the three locations, three case studies, was isolated there. And even in the case of family, there was a limited transfer. It was mostly other things such as dance, language, food. You had refugee settlements and villages that were totally ignoring the refugee identity. And there are many reasons behind that. We can talk especially in relation to the case of the Central Macedonia, where Asia Minor refugees were used in order for the consolidation of the Greek state and the homogenization of the country. So there are many historical reasons why this identity was, to an extent, a hidden identity. And it came as a surprise to me, because in the third generation, there is a memory boom. But of course, if we see things in a more contextual historical way, we realize that because I'm referring to different generations, the third generation is a generation that we have between the mid-60s and mid-80s. During this period, we have the establishment of the Third Hellenic Republic. We have gradual multiculturalism, different developments, and also Holocaust memory that plays a major role in that. we have the establishment of many refugee associations, and the stated mission was the reawakening of this memory. So it is mostly from the third generation onwards and the fourth generation that this memory comes to the forefront in a more prominent way, and it becomes an identity of pride. It wasn't. It was an identity in the context of a family, in most times, a hidden identity. And of course, because we mentioned different levels of memory, there is fluidity between those levels of memory. And it seems that when one level of memory is absent, say family history, another level of memory is reactivated, say refugee associations, or the national memory in limited cases. As far as your empirical question is concerned, well, indeed, it's very difficult to imply a causal relationship, as you can imagine, because it seems that based on the way the subject of analysis perceive their identity, they have a different, they have different attitudes and views. And I mean, although this seems like it's not very innovative to argue that refugee identity leads to empathy, hostility, and competition. Of course, it's more complicated than that. However, this is an important finding in order to complicate quantitative studies that group, say, refugees or the subject of analysis under one category, a category which is much more nuanced in reality than that. However, there are patterns. And without patterns, we don't have findings. The strongest causality, I would say, and we didn't analyze the other case studies, so my apologies for that, but if you are, as you can see, the strongest combination for empathy is that if you're from Lesbos and fourth generation, Asian minor refugee, and the most negative combination is Central Macedonia and being a descendant of the second generation. And in relation to the case of Central Macedonia, because we talk about Lesbos, it's mostly the particularities of the context. I call this chapter devoted on Central Macedonia, the title of the chapter, if I can recall correctly, is From Refugees to Guardians of the Borders. And it actually describes how this population used to a great extent through homogenization policies as guardians of the borders, and they still carry this identity and they take this identity very seriously to the extent that they still have very tense relations with the native population. They questioning their greatness. And the last thing I'm going to say about your second question was that even in the case of Lesbos, because you refer to Golden Dome, things like that, there was a surprising, perhaps to me, discrepancy between views and attitudes. In many cases, I conducted interviews, and interviewees were telling me we're very negative. We vote for, you know, the far right X party. We don't want migrants and things like that. And of course, those interviews were very long interviews, say 3 hours, 3 hours and a half. By the end of the interview, or in the middle of the interview, they were also saying, well, yes, of course I have a second room, and I gave it to migrants that were coming from, you know, they had to stay for a couple of days, and I was cooking for them and things like that. So we also need to be very careful why implying assumptions like between X's and Z's, because it seems that sometimes attitudes and there is a major discrepancy between views and attitudes that you cannot trace.
Yes, no, I think that's fascinating. I mean, the quick comment I would add there is, I guess, internationally we know from lots of survey research that an individual can be, in general, have a very negative attitude, but when actually meeting someone in person, very positive. So it's far more likely that you become sympathetic to someone who is in front of you, rather than the big theme of am I in favour of migration or whatever. Okay, great.
there are a number of people in the audience who know about these things much better than me, so let me open up to questions and comments, please. We'll begin with Anatha Stiga.
Thank you. Remarkable research, very well done. Fantastic. I've learned so many things, so thank you very, very much. I guess I have two questions. Perhaps you have already covered that in your research, but I was wondering, it has to do with the first part of your presentation regarding identity formation for Asian minors. I was wondering whether you have also incorporated your research the attitude of the home country, which is Greece, and the attitude towards them through history, which of course you said that it has changed, clearly. But one of the components that we are missing in Greece is that Asia Minor is part of Turkey, and these people have never been classified as Turks. And their Turkish identity had never been relevant within the Greek context. This somehow had been excluded, neglected, I don't know, suppressed maybe. So I think it's quite important to think of the social context when we try to understand the social identification of any group. And in that sense, I would like to ask you about the second part of your presentation, which was about the refugees coming from Syria and Pakistan and wherever they were coming. Again, it has to do with the wider socioeconomic context of the country, the islands, and the country as a whole. In the beginning, things were better socioeconomically. People were much more willing to offer help because they didn't feel the pressure, the socioeconomic pressure, but suddenly, apparently the numbers having inflated of the refugees, apparently they start feeling the pressure in terms of the socioeconomic impact. And therefore, it's only natural that eventually they would become more negative because they can see the impact, the actual impact in their everyday life. So I was wondering whether the wider social context of any chronological period you have been focusing on has actually an input, has something to tell us about the ways refugees have been, the way they have experienced their own identities.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Lee.
Thanks, Lee.
Brilliant. Thank you very much for the questions and comments. Indeed, the socioeconomic and historical impact that you mentioned is to a great extent the shaping framework of this research, because we need to contextualize the case studies. As far as background information is concerned, I ran a few interviews during the migration crisis, but the main body of the research was in 2019 was, yes. So just to give you the context, regarding the first part of your question, the historical context and the attitudes of Greece to them, I did consider it mostly in a more historical way, the reception conditions and the tense relations with the newcomers. And of course, because I also did archival research, you have hostility, negativity mostly towards the newcomers. And in fact, the Turkish component, which was regional, but the Turkish component of their identification lies in various characterizations, very well-known characterizations. Asia Minor refugees were called by natives as Turkish seeds, baptized in yogurt. There was a very strong orientalistic perspective, actually, in those characterizations. So I do cover the historical part. In relation, though, to the contemporary attitudes, the focus is on refugees, on Asia Minor refugees and subsequent waves of migrants, but I also included a control sample, having natives and other migrants and refugees from various migration waves, just to analyze the potential discrepancies and issues that may vary from one group to the other. And it seems that for natives, the integration of Asia Minor refugees is pretty much unquestionable. In relation to, yes, to the socioeconomic situation with regards to the contemporary migration crisis, indeed it played a role, and it was mostly in areas that you had exposure to refugee camps. We have a map somewhere here. So what I try to do, because I also follow the regional historical approach, I try to select various case studies. Some of them were directly exposed to current migrants and refugees. You had houses literally next to accommodation facilities and things like that. And I also focus my research on control cities and towns that were not exposed to this issue at all. So of course you can see changes in relation to that. It was mostly in the case of Lesbos that during the economic crisis people were saying, why are these people are supported by organizations faulty accusations. They were saying we pay them and we don't have money and things like that, but it was a component, not the most prominent one, surprisingly, but of course it is embedded in the context that I was contacting my field group.
I guess just following up on that, if I may, perhaps one of the contrasts is that in the current crisis,
mm-hmm.
there are European and international organizations
yeah.
that are supporting migrants, whereas in 1923 and afterwards, I guess it's the Greek government and the population.
And the Red Cross. I mean, had an international framework,
yes,
because, well, and this goes to your first point about the historical context. It's the transition from, as you know, empires to nation state, the first compulsory population exchange in history, and the international
yes.
component is also there, but not as in a prominent way.
Vasily.
Thanks, Kevin. Thanks, Marilena, for the presentation and the discussion. I want to press a bit more on this point about sort of the intergenerational transmission versus transmission through other channels, and then what you say about sort of how, in the second part, you know, the presentation, how the lived experiences or memories or constructed memories or identities affect sort of, you know, the relation with the new waves of refugees and migrants, and this thing about empathy, hostility, and competition. And it seems to me that, you know, especially when you say that, you know, there's a gap in the second generation mainly, so transmission from first to third, and maybe second to fourth, but also possibly first to fourth, or whatever, although they didn't probably meet physically. So it kind of is consistent with the story where it says that, you know, the if you want, the political environment in Greece up to the 60s didn't allow for public narratives about Asia Minor disasters and mixed populations. So then with the restoration of democracy after 74, and especially after Pasok came to power, then, of course, all these migrant refugee associations blossomed. You know, different politics, different understanding of. So then, you know, you can call it transmission from first generation to third generation. You know, I mean, I'm not doubting that some of it existed, yeah. But in a way, I would expect a more kind of detailed discussion about how the role of media, as well as state and non-state organizations, kind of cultivate or encourage this thing. Because also it's not then the third generation necessarily, anecdotally from people I know, rediscovering the refugee status, but it's just rediscovering or reclaiming some sort of cultural heritage, more broadly defined. So, okay, why am I saying all this? So I would think that even people who are, you know, kind of natives, old Greeks, whatever it means, would also have patterns of empathy, hostility, and competition. And in a way, going to the methodological point, you know, you mentioned, you know, I had this, you know, sort of also locations which were not treated, so control locations, control. But I didn't see, you know, kind of much of a discussion about what is specifically, you know, what is specific to having a refugee history or identity versus what is natural, because there's a lot of variation that comes from the other side. You know, the Syrian refugees are refugees. You can see on TV the house is burning, yeah, and the taste. You know, a Pakistani or a Nigerian person is not exactly the same, you know, the economic migrant. Also, the first 5,000 people are much more welcome than the next 5 million people, and so forth. So, you know, this pattern of negotiation and, you know, competition and hostility and stuff is kind of natural from the supply side. So, I'm wondering to what extent, if you had looked at natives, you would have come to a significantly different narrative about how they engage with the refugees. Sorry, long way to ask a very simple question.
Wait. Now I need a long way. No, excellent question, and it totally makes sense to me. I mean, where is the difference between the native population, people with no refugee background, and Asia Minor refugees? Let's start very briefly by covering the first part of the question, which will bring us to actually the latter. I didn't imply that transmission happens in the context of a family exclusively. You were right by saying, of course, there is a broader context. As a broader argument, I would say that the transmission of Asia Minor refugee memory is in close alignment with trauma theory. This is why at some point I mentioned there are the three stages of trauma. Trauma is silent, then it's latent, and then there is a reawakening. And this actually is something that my research also confirms. However, is it in a theory in a vacuum? Certainly not. I didn't talk about generations. Very briefly, I, following Mannheim's definition, obviously, I define generation as related age groups embedded in a social historical context. So the social historical context matters a lot. The second generation, 40s and 60s, we have the legacy of the Civil War, we have a gradual economic recovery, homogenization policies. These people are trying to get integrated into the whole society. Asia Minor refugee memory is not their main issue. They're trying to survive. The third generation, 60s and 80s, there is a regime change. There is a passage, a gradual passage from monoculturalism to multiculturalism. And Greece is slowly becoming from an immigration country to an immigration country. And of course, this adds an extra layer of, you know, a helping layer to bring Asia Minor refugee identity to the fore. And then the fourth generation, mid-80s to 2000s, globalization, secularization, Europeanization, different processes that help the establishment of collective frameworks of remembrance. And of course, collective frameworks of remembrance in most cases played a role of paramount importance for the triggering, the reawakening, and the transmission of these identities. If it was up to the family sphere, in many cases, this identity would have failed. And there are various differences in different case studies. In Attica, for example, in Central, in Lesbos, we had stronger intergenerational memories. In Attica, we have the concept of descending history. Even now, this identity fades and fades. So we have different intensities of memory. So what's the difference between refugees and non-refugees? And of course, this, for example, the binary distinctions that we're saying, Syrians and the rest. This is something that we heard over the media and things like that. So I had to take into account those. And there is a shaping, perhaps impact, it goes without saying. What I did in order to discover any differences was what I said earlier, the control group. So in each of these locations, I had a control group, not as representative, inevitably, in terms of numbers. as my core group of natives, of the so-called natives. And you could see clear discrepancies because, of course, there is an inner bias. The context of the interview is a bias. People having Asian minor refugee identities were tending to describe their attitudes through their identity by putting to the forefront their identity. And for example, on Lesbos that we discuss, natives' attitudes were very significantly different from Asian minor refugees. I would say that the main finding for them was mostly not competition. Competition was not there. It was mostly prejudice, hostility, in some cases empathy, but it was mostly skepticism and things like that. So it was through patterns that this difference came to light, I would say.
Okay, good. Please, Kira.
Thank you, Magdalena, very much for this presentation. I've really enjoyed the discussion as well so far. And I wanted to say that one reason why I find this work that I hear for the first time developed actually so much so useful is because we try to build narratives to counter racism or to counter certain political attitudes based on, you know, the receptors that the local society has. And I think one of the really kind of neat things of this book, which I look forward to see coming out, is that, you know, I think it's a great, you know, it provides a very, very kind of important foundation for, you know, understanding what kinds of narratives you can build in what kinds of places and what kinds of narratives are more likely to resonate with people and building kind of on the local conditions. And so I wondered if I could kind of continue a little bit on the conversation. My first question you just answered, which was just what's the difference, yeah, exactly, what we were discussing with Vasilis. But I wanted to ask if you could talk a little bit. I really enjoyed the Lesbos case study, but I have kind of a personal interest in the difference between Central Macedonia and Attica. And to continue a bit on the discussion about social context, I would say, kind of, do you develop the argument kind of exclusively based on the historical status of people in Macedonia as kind of the, you know, the people who expanded the frontiers of the country? Or does kind of different trajectories of socioeconomic development come into the comparison at all in your analysis?
Brilliant, thank you very much. To be honest, my initial idea was to present Central Macedonia as a case study, but then I realized that it's such a complicated case study and you need a lot of background, because as you said, actually it's a mixture of both.
Mm-hmm.
And my argument goes in this way. The particularities of Central Macedonia as a case study following a more historical perspective is that we have and of course we have the same in Attica, but in Central Macedonia it comes in a more prominent way. We have three different subgroups of Asia Minor refugees. I mean, there is a lot of discussion behind that, but my analysis examined them under the same umbrella but through different subcategories, and I'm referring to Asia Minor refugees, descendants from Pontus, and descendants from Eastern Thrace. So you had, in this case study, three subgroups of Asia Minor refugees with different senses of identities, and it was very interesting, with a very interesting sense of competition between them as well. Descendants from Asia Minor and descendants from Pontus, there is a bit of contestation regarding the genocide issue. They tend to have competitive, they have established separate organizations, they have different memorials, so it's a very interesting case. So in this case, it's interesting to see the heterogeneity of displacement through different elements such as language, music, food, culinary, culture, and things like that. But I would mostly say that, although I wouldn't neglect the economic component, it was a very important component, the way they built their identities, that refugees had a very important ethnological impact on the homogenization of Greece. And to me, that was the most prominent element of their identities until now in relation to their attitudes to subsequent migration, of course. For example, they perceived Pontics, Greek Albanians, Pontic Greeks in the 90s, and Syrians as brothers. And they had many family stories because many Asian Minor refugees in Central Macedonia were actually came to Greece through Syria. So they told me repeatedly that they need to return the hospitality and things like that. And on the other hand, they were very, very negative towards the rest, migrants, the non-Syrian population, towards Albanians, and actually readdressing again Vasilis' point and Kira's point, which is totally right. I also wanted to stress that, for example, when you have binary distinctions, and they say, well, the Syrians and the rest, and you have an identical answer from a native, the main difference that I found in the way they framed the answer is the fact that they use the cornerstones of their identity and the cornerstones of the Asia Minor refugee identities, traumatic history of displacement, language, culture, and religion, apologies. So those are the cornerstones of the Asia Minor refugee identity, and they use these cornerstones in order to safeguard their identity in relation to current migrants and refugees, which is something that never obviously came. I mean, in some cases, it was an issue of religion and Islam and things like that. But as a combination, the cornerstones of the Asia Minor refugee identity was, to an extent, to use a metaphor, an identity shield towards the newcomers. Those are the elements of our identity. They have different identities, and it seems that they're threatening our identity.
Please.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, a well-researched and concise report. I can identify with some of the stuff. Being my grandmother had to flee, as a young girl with her mother, after she lost her father, her maternal grandfather, and her two older brothers. One of her older brothers is actually still missing. Nobody knows what ever happened to him. So I can identify with all that. And although what she suffered, my grandmother, as I remember, at any one time did I ever hear her say anything bad about Turkish people, because she was a very pious woman, and she never said anything. And she used to, Turkish was far better than the Greek as well. And she actually became a refugee twice in her life, in 1974 in Cyprus.
Mm-hmm.
And the officer that walked literally in the house, because my grandfather wouldn't leave, so she stayed, my uncles all left, and the officer, funny enough, when he walked in there, he thought she was Turkish. And as it turned out, he was from the same part where she came from. So that's what I can sort of reflect on that. But on a more delicate matter, how did you deal with the ethnic cleansing? How did you deal with that, if people mention it? Because that phrase did not really enter our vocabulary until the 1990s during the Serb-Bosnian wars. And to this day, there is no, under international criminal law, there's no legal definition of ethnic cleansing, and yet it's still a crime against humanity, and it may fall within the Convention of Genocide. It may. So I'm very curious how you deal with that, because the Lausanne Treaty, for example, is nothing but illegal ethnic cleansing. It suited basically Britain and France, being that they were the major imperial powers at the time, and also with the USA entering the framework. So I'm very curious, it's a very delicate matter. So some historians actually, which I take issue with them, they don't define that. It's not really ethnic cleansing, but I beg to differ with them on that issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Not glad to know that you had a similar family history.
Sorry.
It's interesting that you have a similar family history, Of course, it's not a happy thing to say, because it's history of forced displacement. You were right highlighting this discrepancy between, and René Harrison has done important work on that, but the fact that these people were mostly nostalgic or romantic about their Turkish past. And it's interesting because while examining archival testimonies of the first generation, this is a very prominent element. In many cases they say, we were friends with the Turks. And this reminds us the discrepancy between history as lived and history as recorded.
Mm.
So we need to bear in mind that indeed history as lived can be a different thing, and national narratives, collective narratives, add a complexity or sometimes blurry individual testimonies or history as lived. In relation to ethnic cleansing, of course, the Asia Minor population exchange is a product of a very particular time in history, the consolidation of nation states from empire to nation state, as we said. There were many different models in dealing with the minority question or the minority problem, as they were saying in 1919, from ethnic cleansing, mass killings, to compulsory population exchange or legal frameworks. In 1919, we have the establishment of the first legal frameworks in dealing with the minority issue in Poland under the Polish Minority Treaty. The issue of ethnic cleansing came especially from descendants from Asia Minor and Podus a lot during my interviews. And most of the descendants from Podus use the term genocide. And they emphasize their right to memory. And there is a very big discussion about this issue, who has a right to memory, how open-ended or not open-ended is the concept of genocide. And of course, I'm not a genocide expert. But there is an interesting discussion regarding the refugee associations and their attempts, their continuous attempt to use the concept genocide rather than ethnic cleansing in order to refer to the Asia Minor forced displacement.
There would, be an interesting contrast with perhaps the Muslims who were displaced from Greece to the Turkish Republic, and their attitudes towards migrants arriving in Turkey. And this point about first generation memory chimes, because some years ago I did research about Muslims who had been displaced into Turkey and their recollections of their Greekness, of their Greek experience. And indeed, quite often, they would wish to emphasize that as children, we played across communities. We were in the same mixed area. We have no animosity of memory towards Greeks in Western Thrace. Plays to your point about how it is then potentially reinterpreted subsequently,
mm-hmm.
but also this point that third generation perhaps are more likely to hear it than second generation. We had some evidence of that. Other comments or questions, please.
Thank you. That was really nice. I think the question is very poignant, and I've been thinking about it personally, because my family are descendants of Greek communists who were born in the village of Belogyanis in Hungary. So they left Greece as refugees, political refugees, political philosophies, as you know. My parents returned to Greece and all my family, but very many of that community in Hungary are now very fervent organists. And during the 2015 crisis and all the scenes that we saw at the Hungarian border, there were very themselves as children of refugees, some of them of older age, having memories of having left Greece to arrive in Romania and in Hungary through boats sailing around Europe, reaching Poland and going down on the trains. So I've wondered about how is it possible they are refugees and so very anti-refugees. I was wondering specifically about your data, very rich set. Do you have any cases, references to similarities or differences in material culture between refugees, arrivals, and your participants? For example, in Lesbos, I like how you showed the traditional costumes. The women's traditional costume in Lesbos is a salvare, is a very like oriental looking kind of dress. The hair is always covered. Did you have any such instances where people might have said they look like exactly like what my grandmother used to wear or things like that?
Thank you very much. Well, regarding your first comment, this is something that I found also very striking and fascinates me a lot, especially with the case of Hungary. It's a very interesting case study. I would say that it seems that the element of competitive victimization is very prominent there, our identity and their identity. And in this slide, I also wanted to mention this dynamic and interchanging idea of the established and the outsider. This changes a lot, and it seems that the outsider becomes the established and vice versa. For example, while conducting some of the interviews that I haven't included in the DIFI project, I was also conducting interviews with Albanians and Bulgarians and Romanians in the 19th, and they were very, very negative towards the current migrants and refugees. They were saying, well, we shouldn't accept them. We need to close our borders. They became the established to a great extent, perhaps in a subjective sense, not necessarily in subjective, in an objective sense. But it's interesting, this idea and how dynamic it is. In relation to material culture, that's a very interesting comment. Well, you could see that mostly, that was mostly evident in descendants of the first and the second generation. There is a picture that I don't have it here now, with an Asia Minor refugee wearing his Asia Minor attire to an extent, and he was very well known in Lesbos. And they were just limited instances, and they have, they're mostly related with commemoration purposes. So in the context of, let me find the slide, celebrations, well, I won't find it. Or, yes. So it's mostly in the context of celebrations through refugee associations and things like that. But I haven't reflected in depth on that point. Thanks for mentioning that.
Sure.
The point about the initial refugee wave becoming established and not wanting to have other refugees reminds me a bit of Suella Braverman.
I was going to say exactly the same, but I thought it would be a cheap and nasty comment to make.
I wanted to ask you something else. In your research on the 1923 dimension of refugees, especially the case of Asia Minor, there's other communities which you haven't mentioned at all, and that's the Armenian community, which is fundamentally important to Smyrna and the area around Smyrna. And it seems to me that there's a tremendous difference between the Armenian diaspora and the Hellenic refugees who went to Greece. And I think there's an idea of Hellenism, community and belonging, which makes what you've researched quantitatively different from the Armenian experience, where these people left their own communities, which were completely multicultural. They had no homeland to go to. They had a previous experience of genocide as well. And they have a completely different feeling towards anything to do with Turkey and Asia Minor from the people that you've met in your research or that we know anecdotally from family experience and historical experience. So did you come across this at all in your research?
I would say the convenient thing that it was outside the scope of the study, though. You're absolutely right. And of course, because it's a very complicated story, and indeed it wasn't a part of my narrative. The only thing that I can testify about is Armenians who came to Greece after the Armenian genocide. Not in a very systematic way. It happened that I interviewed some of them. The interesting thing, of course, as you can imagine, the concept of silence was very prominent in their stories because of the dramatic dimension of what happened in Asia Minor. It was interesting because their memory, it's not very well organized. It's almost still a refugee in the family sphere. And while they were framing their experiences to me, they were using the broader Asia Minor refugee term in order to squeeze their experience into that. So it seems that their right to memory was under the umbrella of the Asia Minor refugee memory rather than as a standalone experience in the context of Greece. But of course, it's not that I researched this group in a thorough way. Those are some observations based on fieldwork.
Great. Sorry.
Doesn't this point on this, but doesn't this suggest that, you know, the kind of memory and identity is really constructed, you know, socially constructed, and you know, the Pontiacs obviously have their own thing, and in many ways they're not, you know, what we think of as a man. But if the Armenians self, you know, categorize themselves into the Asia Minor thing, it doesn't speak to the fact that, you know, there's something that has been constructed. I think even, you know, people I know from Kozani who can go four generations back in Kozani, they would still recite what, you know, many people were saying, like, you know, our grandparents were refugees. No, they weren't. You know, 20 generations Kozani. Our parents were migrants, you know, economic migrants. Will you become racist? You know, that is a collective memory. And it doesn't matter if you're a refugee or, you know, I mean, you know, you definitely know people who are refugees, but, you know, you have somebody in your family. This is something that I think people who are many generations Greeks, whatever that means, non-refugees, they would still say that. So just, you know, picking on that point about the Armenians putting themselves, as you said.
No, memory and identity is constructed and reconstructed and formed and reformed. And this is a very dynamic process over time, generations and historical locations and, you know, geography. We need to highlight the subjectivity of someone says, well, I'm a refugee. The element of subjectivity is a very important element while examining or unpacking or exploring refugee identities. The element of construction component is there. And because we have different levels of memory. We have family memories, individual memories, we have collective memories, and we have national memories. And you said something very interesting. You said, well, if I understood it correctly, does it matter? Because no, it's a national memory to a great extent, or a collective memory. It wasn't always this way. It wasn't a part of the national narrative or a part of our collective memory. And it's interesting to explore this interplay between the different levels of memory, how this memory that started as an individual memory became a national memory. And this is a very dynamic thing. During the Civil War, this identity, it wasn't a national identity, especially because of the left-wing political leanings. So I feel that, yes, to a great extent, this identity is constructed through familial, collective, and national frameworks of remembrance, and the subjectivity that this identity brings and informs and reinforces these different levels of analysis is what makes Asia Minor refugee identity interesting as a case.
That's a wonderful point to finish on, because I see a link with our next event, which is this Thursday. Let me just remind you that this Thursday we're going to have a discussion about the 50th anniversary of the student uprising at the Athens Polytechnic, and we will have a number of people who were active at that time. Let me simply say that it's this Thursday at 6:30 p.m. and it's in the LSE Lecture Theatre in the centre building here at the school. It's free and open to all. It will be available both in person and online. And we have Nikos Christolakis, who was a student at the Polytechnic and is now a professor at that same institution. Zenobia Laliotti, who is an assistant professor in the University of Athens, who's researched on these events. Yorgos Pavlakis, who was a medical student and helping those injured. And Calliope Rigopoulou, a professor at the University of Athens. And I think she was the lady who was photographed on top of the tank in the Athens Polytechnic uprising. In any event, that's this Thursday, looking at the 50th anniversary of the Polytechnic, memory, identity, social construction. The themes continue. History is not about the past, it's about the present. But we've had a great discussion here, linking with many different aspects. So, Marilyn, thank you very much indeed.